I'm an 11-year offender from Zambia. I love the country. I'm happy there. I don't know why CDC lets me stay. But I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the electronic health record system there. Primarily, I'm going to talk about the second thing that one is interested after one collects data, one's interested in using it. But I'm going to talk about confidentiality and security elements that lead up to that, and then some of the considerations that we've tried to address in making this data useful. A little bit about Zambia first, then a little bit about the smart care system itself, and then a quick walk through some of the role-based security elements of the system, and then I would like to talk about what we call the smart query data access to the growing amounts of data, about 500,000 patients, millions of encounters, just a lot of data, and how do you make use of that and still control confidentiality and security. 13 million people, not a huge country, but there are smaller countries around. We have changing numbers of districts this year, and so that makes all of our GIS applications more fun. And this sort of gives you a little bit of a picture. I like to show this graphic just because money follows electricity, or electricity follows money, and information follows both. And so you can see, I wish I had a pointer here, but you can see Lusaka with the lower arrow is on the edge of a very dark patch when viewed from the nighttime sky. This is a local view, Victoria Falls or Mosio Tunya. It's named after a local beer, or maybe it was the other way around. And this vision for the smart care EHR is probably the vision that everyone has for their electronic health record system. You'd like every man, woman, and child to have one. You'd like every point of service to be able to access and update it. You'd like every clinician to understand it, be committed to it. And you'd like every facility and institution to be making use of that data and feeding back reactions, consolidations, guidance, policy, new clinical protocols into the system that's generating the data so that you have a continuous progress, continuous iteration. This is a slide from 2004. They had colors back then. And this is from the M&E presentation for the first M&E conference for the PEPFAR initiative here in Atlanta. And basically the point I was trying to make, and boy, it's an awful loud slide, is that it could be that the money that's coming through PEPFAR, and this was 7 years ago, I guess, or more, and the emergency that the HIV epidemic represented, and the requirements for reporting in order to keep the money coming, represented a confluence, you know, a perfect storm of elements required to motivate people to move from paper records to electronic so that one could both have the benefits of electronic health records and the benefits of the M&E that one needed for the PEPFAR program. So that was sort of what was on my mind in April or May, whenever it was, of 2004. And then I was fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time to work on that some. And so this is a little bit of report back on what we've done so far along these lines. And so a little bit of a chronology here. I'm not going to read it. But in red, there's a couple things that we did up front. Consensus and establishment of unique identifier. That put us roughly 7 years or so ahead of the United States. Maybe more, I don't know. Some of the technologies that we used in Zambia, the project actually began initially as a bridge. The smart card itself was a manifestation of an analysis of 57 paper documents the ministry already had, 1,832 data elements that were unique on those documents, and that smart card was intended to hold that sort of central piece that all players could share. and get data from one point of service to the next. It wasn't called Smart Care, it's called the Continuity of Care Project, because we weren't planning to build software, we were planning to connect existing operations. What actually happened on the ground was that the first application we were going to connect with didn't come out, so we built a little pilot to show how it would work, and people liked our touchscreen smart card combination pilot better than the other systems, and within a few months it was the national system. Prematurely, probably, but that's what happened. And so the context in Zambia is that you have a disconnected environment. You don't have internet connecting all the sites. And almost every EHR, or electronic medical record system, that you hear about here will be talking about internet, how it facilitates connectivity and getting the data from one point to the next. And almost every EHR in this country and in Europe and in the Far East is internet dependent. Smart Care is not. Either in Zambia or Ethiopia, it's dependent instead on just-in-time information access carried by a client. And I'll wave one of those cards around in a moment. South Africa has a very pretty one. Zambia, of course, has the big waterfall on their card. And Ethiopia has things on it that I can't read, unfortunately. It's in Amharic. But the notion is that if you don't have connectivity via wireless or immediate electronic internet connections, you can have the patient carry their data from point to point, and that's fast enough for the patient. And it's probably plenty fast for public health as well. And so that was maybe the insight. It's what we had to do to make it work in Zambia. And the other piece was a touchscreen. I think I showed a graphic of that a moment ago. We have a lot of users that have never seen a computer before. Maybe the majority of people outside of the cities that are using computers in Zambia learned on Smart Care. It's really a strange situation. But my wife, who worked for JICA and tried to teach clinicians to type in 2001, 2002 for a different project, taught me something. It's very hard to do. But instead, if you give them a touchscreen interface and a keyboard sitting in front of it, in about 6 months, you'll find that very many of them are typing. Not all of them, but very many. So the way Smart Care works, then, in the absence of telecommunications in the traditional sense, is a sneaker net once a month when the HMIS data is rolled up, the old pre-existing paper system. A flash drive goes along with that same person from the facility to the district and consolidates information at the district. This also provides an opportunity for a patient who's been to multiple facilities to have their different clinical visit data integrated and redistributed back to those facilities they chose to visit. Now, patient data isn't sent in identified form to facilities they have not gone to, but it is recirculated in complete health record form to facilities they have previously attended. So some of the elements of the confidentiality design, I guess, if you will, are the things that all of you know. Some of this will be pretty old hat to all of you. There's a lot of international law about confidentiality. There are committees at UNAIDS that have produced documents in the recent years. Some of the basic principles are you let people have access on the basis of a need to know. You have strictures. You give them the least privileges necessary for them to do their jobs. Those are sort of standard things. Other standard things is if you're a provider, you should have access to all of their data. If you're a researcher, you should have access to only those things that have been consented and approved by boards. And if you're a public health practitioner, you're sort of in the middle. And that's sort of the interesting piece for many of us is to what extent does a public health practitioner have a prerogative, a right, a need to know some of this data, and in what form should it be? And so now we've got, you know, millions of clients with lots of data. And so you can almost think of two different pyramids, one right side up and one upside down. We've got millions of patients and you know, thousands, 26,000 users, going on up to maybe some users that are qualified users for doing statistics and other users as you approach the pinnacle of the pyramid who actually might have a reason to have access to very specific and identifiable or sensitive data. On the other hand, you've got this huge amount of data that is potentially sensitive and identifiable, and you can imagine it getting filtered in terms of need to know and in terms of particular applications, in terms of role-based security, until it narrows down to an indicator here or an indicator there. And so you have sort of these two different pyramids, and what you want is you want to minimize the unnecessary overlap of the degree of access and the number of people. Now, some of the things here that we've done, of course, you have login access to your systems. But most security issues have to do with people, and people are your weak spot. People are what get socially engineered to hack systems. And so the things you do with the hardware, the things you do with some of the security that you think of in the software probably are less important than the training you do, the policies you set, the precedents you set, the support from the government and the ministry for protections and respect for individual privacy. One of the things that we did that is different than most, but not all, is that by virtue of having to have a disconnected environment, we sort of made a virtue of that necessity in terms of partitioning our risk. And so we don't have all the identified data in any place. There is the national identified data set is a virtual data set that does not physically exist anywhere. It's partitioned, and you just have the data that each facility needs at that facility. But what does roll up is de-identified, what you might call microdata, that rolls from the facility to the district, to the province, and to either implementing partners or national interests. And so some of the things by which we filter, if you will, who accesses and when they access the data, SmartCare can control access by person identity, by the role of a person, by whether or not they're a provider or non-provider of clinical services, whether their scope is limited to just being a laboratorian or a well care service like VCT or a pharmacist, or whether they actually provide clinical decisions, in which case they maybe have access or need to have access to more. You have risk graded reports. You have reports that might have a lot of detail about an individual, a single record report. It might even have family member, HIV status, things like that, that extend even beyond that one individual, all the way to the other end of the spectrum with public use data sets that may be aggregate, non-sensitive, and non-identifiable with regard to their content. These pre-canned reports in SmartCare are classified, all of them are classified according to this spectrum, and when roles are assigned, one can assign roles according to that gradation. There are also access gradations for risk, whether you can just view something, whether you can view it and print it, or whether you can actually export the data and walk somewhere with it. This is pretty dry stuff, but I think it's very important. It keeps people from getting hurt, and it keeps systems from being shut down. And so these life-saving systems need to have these nuts and bolts, I think, to persist. So just walking through some slides very quickly, you have login, you have a verification when someone logs in, are they right place, is the system time set right, is the facility identified correctly. You have a lookup where you have verification of things that you find. You have an administration space where you administrate security. Whoops, going the wrong way here. And you have a bunch of possible role-based security sets, a lot of different possible definitions for how you want to manage your role-based security. This is a particular instance of a role-based security set. It has maybe three axes here, whether a person's a provider or not, what clinical services they may be involved in, and then in particular, all the checkboxes off to one side, which are various roles. Some of those roles manifest as you see the view, print, or export dimension, but some others off to the right, you might see three that, I don't know if you can read that at all, headed by the term smart query, and that's what I want to talk to you about most the rest of this talk. Smart query is the name that we've given to the ad hoc use of this pooled micro data, this de-identified data. We've had a lot of demand for accessing the raw data. Everybody wants to get in there and play. They want to do, they want to look around. They want to do good. They want to find out things that no one ever knew about the patterns in this population. Well-motivated people. And so these are just some more of the role-based security elements. And so when you come back to this application, after having established appropriate roles for users, the next thing you want to do is, or they want to do, is access your data. I mean, somebody else is entering these records. There's 500,000 of them. So how do they look at patterns and trends? So in a prior life, I developed a system at CDC called Wonder and a tool after that called HERS, Health Information Retrieval System, which was an early OLAP tool in the late 80s and early 90s. So I'm very much interested in rapid access to large data sets, but also interested in how you can do that in a safe way. And so we enable the functionality we call Smart Query, which is actually a view in a database sense of these large files at the ministry or at lower levels. And a view is basically a virtual look at a table or set of tables that might be joined by some logic. But a query set, then, is a query. That's a SQL command, if you will, that says what part of these data sets you want to look at, bundled with roles and rights. And so by making a package out of a particular slice of this large data set and the rights one needs to have to access it, you have sort of an object that knows what it should do no matter where it is in the system. And so this little object we call a query set. And this query set is something that has to be defined at the ministry level. The ministry has stewardship of this data and of the access to the data. And this query set then is a definition that propagates through this system or is distributed with releases of the system and allows users to access slices of data. And the principle here is that if you access 40 or 50 fields from an electronic health record, very likely you'll be able to identify someone. My wife delivered my 7-year-old, or I delivered my wife of my 7-year-old, during a period of time when I was responsible for the HIV surveillance in Zambia. And in prior years, I'd helped the ministry produce reports by 5-year age groups, rolled up at the facility level with prevalence rates for each of these groups. And as it happens, my wife was the only person in her 5-year age group. Everybody knew where she delivered. Everyone knew she was pregnant. And so my standard report would have identified my wife's HIV status. So that's not a whole lot of fields. That's an age, that's a facility, that's a pregnancy status, or several things that are visible. And it doesn't take a lot to actually divulge sensitive information. And that's a message that we've been preaching for a long time in Zambia, but it is sort of hard to tell people not to look at their data. You don't want that. You want them to use it as much as possible. And so this query set approach is an approach that allows you to narrow the data set to fields of interest. So how many fields does it take to do a PEPFAR indicator, for instance? It doesn't take all 2,000 fields in SmartCare. It maybe takes 5, it maybe takes 8, sometimes 12. And you can make those fields available in a multitude of combinations and permutations to allow almost all the different kinds of analyses that people want to do to be done. And each of those little sets might be called a query set, and each of them can have the attributes of access and control that they need to protect access to this larger file. One can also define a query set to exactly match a research protocol, the approved set of fields for the approved duration for one PI to access and get its data live as that data gets created. And you can also create a query set for a slice the ministry fields as public use, in which case everybody can access it and you can even post it on the internet. And so that's sort of a strategy I just wanted to share with you. The slides here maybe aren't very interesting, but this is what it looks like. So it's pretty simple to use. If you're using the Express mode, you'll see a couple other tabs there called Administration and Query Build. Those are the tabs that one person in the country or two or three might use to define these query sets. But the main path through this query set or smart query approach is selecting query sets from groups, picking a particular query set within those, looking to see if the fields are the ones of interest that you need if you don't know what the name represents, and then running a query and just making it go. Now, because these files are huge, some of them, you may want to have a subset, and so you also see a size filter at the top. That size filter is based on a modulus function that just lets you basically pick a random set of that file. And you can sort of stipulate the same set each time. If you have multiple tables with identifiers that need to be joined after subsetting, you can get the same slice from each of those by running the modulus on the ID. But that's a technical detail. Basically, this is a fairly simple approach. I think we saw it on some open data government sites, and so we sort of modeled this, figuring that it was something that people would find easy to use. And that's pretty much the presentation. I think there's, if I can advance the screen, there's a slide of some sites and smart care sites in Zambia. And just maybe a few points. We felt that we should do no harm. That meant we worked on security before we worked on access, but we have taken a lot of heat. A lot of people want the access. With regard to security, the enemy is us, and the hardware and the software isn't going to protect you if you don't have people well-trained and well-intended. I think when you de-identify these data sets, when they're large and rich, they are not anonymous. That's a very important point. We find that we have to say it in almost every meeting that we have, because people think if you remove the identifiers, they're not identifiable anymore. And so we just have to say that over and over again. CDC's role in this, we don't have any data, or I would have loved to show you the data. We are sort of a clean shop in the sense that the ministry holds the data for the country, and I think that's the way it should be, but we've helped with writing the software. Data ownership, I think the data belong to the people, the ministry is a steward, and those of us that are visitors really don't own much of anything there, even if we're doing research. The system itself, system ownership, I think comes from cognitive mastery of the software and the technology, and that takes time to establish. Although we have no code ownership concerns about the ministry taking the code, and they have full access to it, the ministry team is not yet as strong as the project team, and I think in some very real sense, you don't own your own software if you can't make it jump through hoops and if consultants can fool you about what you get. And so I think I think you can't have good governance if you don't have good, strong IT capacity. I think there's a lot of discussion about open source. I just wanted to emphasize that I'm not sure that you always want everything open, both as a parent and I think as a long-term government employee. I think there's a lot of things that you don't always make open, whether for confidentiality reasons or public protection reasons or other reasons. And certainly none of you would imagine making your password security systems to your systems open, just to make an obvious example. But I think there is a lot of synergy that comes from open systems, and I think that one has to manage how one shares code, how one shares solutions to technical problems in such a way that that people don't have to reinvent the wheel, but also so that you don't have needless proliferation of systems and countries who struggle enough just trying to manage one system, much less 20 versions of one system. I think the public benefits of a wonderful national EHR solution are limited by the degree to which the public can trust the stewards of that data. In the United States, there is distrust with good reason of people holding data, because in the United States it is a legitimate business practice to use a person's health status against them, in the sense that coverage can, at least until new laws, be denied to people who have certain health status. And so as long as there's that kind of a tradition in a country, the amount of benefit that you are able to get from a national data set like this is much more limited. In Zambia, there has been a different tradition, a different history. People actually trust and expect the government to do the right thing with their data. That remains to be seen that that will always happen, but that is the expectation there. And the willingness to let the government hold this data is somewhat different. And so every country you're in will have a different flavor with regard to what the public will tolerate and to what extent they either rightly or incorrectly trust their governments. And that will limit what can be done for the public good with these large public data sets. And so I think that pretty much wraps up what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sills, for sharing with us some of the wonderful informatics activity that you've been doing in resource constrained setting like Lusaka, Zambia, and showing us some of the real uses of the informatics there. Now the session is open for discussion, and I would like to invite you all to participate in sharing your questions and suggestions and in your comments. And please raise your hand and then state your name and where you're from and go from there. Okay, who would like to go first?
Hi, I'm Teresa Norton, Chapaigo, which is at Johns Hopkins University. And my question is for Mr. Karuki. You mentioned the connectivity challenges. Would you talk to me about or give me some details about your workarounds for that? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. Connectivity, what we are doing currently, with around 55 sites, what we are currently working on is building our own connectivity between all those sites to be able to share the data from the remote sites back to the central. What we did is we reached out to the service providers in the country and just looking at how much they were charging to be able to connect the various sites. So it was so expensive as compared to building our own network. You find that using a service provider, we were getting like five times building our own network to connect the sites. So currently we are almost connecting around 20 sites to begin with, and once we see how that works, then we can extend that to the other sites. But as the charges of internet around Africa goes down, we are hoping maybe in 3-5 years we should be able to partner or move forward and use the infrastructure that exists. And we're also hoping that the government will be able to put to come up with infrastructure, especially for health services. Then we will move on and use that.
Thank you. You have a mic.
Your name. Hi, I'm Joel Greenspan, and I enjoyed all the presentations very much. I would like to follow up on your last statement and extend that to the other speakers, and it's about the internet or the coming internet. I wonder if the other speakers could speculate about wide-scale access to networks, particularly the internet, over the next 3 to 5 years, and in particular, the desirability in the countries that you work in to utilize cloud-based applications for healthcare and public health, particularly if the costs were extremely low.
Thank you, Joel.
Okay. So your question is, can we move to cloud-based? I think part of the major challenges or the question, especially from the last presenter, is the confidentiality of the information. We need to look at what policies exist to ensure that the patient records are protected. Once we get to that point and we are sure that patient information is secure, we should be able to move forward and start using some of that functionality. But the status right now, especially in East Africa, I think even using the cloud is quite a challenge, because even connecting sites that are maybe 20 kilometers apart is a challenge. So we are hoping with time we should be able to move towards that. But the key thing is what policies exist, what is the structure to ensure that patient information is secure.
Hi, Joel. It's nice to see you. It's been ages. In Zambia, in 2000, there were 1,357 health facilities, 200 of which had electricity. It was roughly at that time, I estimated, 5 years between the time electricity got to a facility and telephones got to the same facility. Now we have closer to 2,000 facilities, 1,100 of them have power, and a high percentage, at least according to the ISPs, maybe 95% of the facilities that we're in have a footprint for cellular coverage, for wireless internet. And so what a funny thing is happening. It used to be that electricity would precede communications by a long shot. But now the rate limiting factor is the power and the money it takes to keep the power going. It seems as though the cellular coverage gets done by the market, but the power to the facilities is a government expenditure. And so that seems to be the function in Zambia. I imagine that's variable country to country, but I think in the 3 to 5 year time frame, there is likely to be coverage for almost everywhere in the country if there were power. And power is very susceptible to social disruption, to changes in the global economy, which we're seeing now, just like food. And I think as long as you have famine in these countries, you're going to have facilities without power. And we've had famine for a long time, and I'm not sure it's going away real fast. So I think cellular coverage is sort of a funny thing. It sort of leapfrogs, but whether you can consume it depends on the other infrastructure. That's my take right now. But in 5 years, everything's different.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
For AT, we have a lot of problem with internet connection and power also, but the system is designed to face this problem. For example, if their site have a power failure, they can use the paper forms and enter the data after. If they have internet connection failure, they can use their local server. And now on the 70 site, we have 31 who use a local server. Okay. For the cloud-based data, I will let Lobel, I don't know if you want to say something about this.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to make a comment. I think that I think that it's not real unless it's recorded.
Yeah.
I think that the key is kind of flexible deployment strategies. Wayne Lotion from Johns Hopkins gave a talk on the Essence system, totally different domain, right? Domestic, state-based, and local health jurisdiction surveillance. But he gave a talk on Essence and was sort of describing kind of the same incremental view that we see towards the cloud, that really virtualization of hardware and deployment on virtual machines is kind of the first logical step to make, building appliances rather than building software that gets installed on a server per se. and that those appliances can be deployed in lots of different ways. Those appliances can be deployed on traditional hardware, they can be deployed on a laptop, they can be deployed on on the Amazon EC2 cloud. And so that's the way our software in Kenya and Haiti and Cote d'Ivoire and Namibia, and that's the way our software is developed. So I think that your question, there is an organizational issue to migrating to the cloud, but I think that the technical issue is not that big a deal. It's mostly just taking the right, taking the right technical approach, moving quickly to virtualization.
If I may add something to that, since I didn't respond to the cloud part, I think there are control issues. And if your goat is in my yard, it's my goat. And if it's my goat, I want it in my yard. And that's where I come from. I live in Zambia. And so Zambia specimens don't go out of the country without a year-long debate that we just finished reconciling, but that can change with the next president, which is going to be elected in 4 weeks. We have, I think, one of the reasons why we've been an honest broker development shop is that we understand the government is very sensitive about who holds what data. The Ethiopia Smart Care effort couldn't bring their software to Zambia to share on the server, couldn't bring all of it to Zambia to share on the server when we were doing co-development, because they were at war and they didn't want their GIS data to be out of their control. Okay, so there are degrees of control that people need when they can't feel trust. And this was one of the points I made as my closing point, is that the degree of benefit that people, nations can experience from these integrated solutions, whether they're EHRs or other things in the cloud, is bound and limited by the degree to which societies and people in those societies can trust each other.
Yeah, Mark, I think that's right. I glossed over a whole bunch of things very quickly when I said organizational issues, and you're entirely right. Two really interesting examples, though, that don't come from our work at all, that I think both the Open Data Toolkit, the platform for Android interaction, both the Open Data Toolkit model and the Open LMIS, Logistical Management Information System model, have their intended deployment target for their servers is cloud-based. So both of those servers can be run locally, but I've heard both of those organizations talk about really what ODK wants you to do is instantiate an ODK aggregate server on the cloud. So I think it's really interesting that there is this traditional owner view of traditional view of whatever yard the goat's in, that's that. And I don't know how quickly that's going to be broken down, but I know if somebody wants to move quickly towards Android-based data collection, the quickest, lowest cost way to get it up and running is to use ODK aggregate as a cloud server.
Hi, I'm Roger Friedman. I'd like to ask about medical records. I'd like you to think back to those long ago days before your systems were there. What did the medical records look like? How would you compare the information that was on them with the information that you have today? If you were using patient cards in those days, did you have problems getting physicians to switch over to a encounter form-based approach? And now that you're starting to get some physicians into the organization who never knew the old way, how do you think they would feel about the kind of medical records that they're seeing?
Okay, yeah, initially, most clinicians were using I'll give some scenarios around Kenya. There's still some facilities where a patient goes with a booklet to the clinic, and the physician just fills in the diagnosis and the medication for the patient to go and pick that. But when you introduce a medical record system, you need to get to a point where you are able to structure the data that you collect to be able to query that information later and make some decision based on what you collect over time. And that's part of what will assist the other clinician coming in to use the same. So quite a number of challenges, but with time, as they see the benefits of a certain way of collecting the information, especially using encounter form, they're able to embrace that, because when a patient comes back again and they're able to see a summary sheet, for example, they're able to tell what has been happening on this patient and what is the importance of collecting the information using that. And increasingly we are seeing especially young doctors moving towards embracing informatics and using it in the clinic. But I think we still have some time to get to a point where we'll use like paperless systems that are really informing clinicians on how a patient is doing. So we are still on transition from what was there before, paper-based, and also moving from paper-based to electronic. So I think they are like two different processes going on at the same time.
Before, e-santé, the patient record were not standard. So for a visit, you can have only three sentences or maybe three words. So when you have to report, you don't find the information you need, or maybe the information is there, you cannot read it. So with e-santé, now we have standard forms, and this also facilitated the reports and facilitated also the patient care. The other things, a single patient may have maybe three or four shots in the same site, so the information is shared. But with e-santé, you can have only one file for one patient.
I'm Ed Van Bach. I'm from the University of Connecticut Health Center. And here in America, all of the encounters are focused one patient at a time, and that seems to be the perspective of clinical staff. You all showed some global or some regional perspective and some larger data on more of the public health perspective. Is that filtering down into the clinics, and do your nurses and physicians see that? Do they have access to those reports? You mentioned some of the role-based data. And if so, how is that changing the care where the physician knows his or her panel of patients, which isn't necessarily the case yet in the States?
The answer is that next year we'd like to present on that. Irene, who's sitting down the row from you, has recently implemented something we call a site interaction that allows sort of aggregate data about either a site or the nation to go up and down this cascade in the same way that patient data currently does. And so presently, the data that rolls up doesn't roll all the way back down to each facility. So every facility sees their own data. And then any data that was static data that could have been pushed down in the previous quarter. But it would be possible to have each facility see their own data in the context of the entire country in a fairly real-time way as well. And so that's something that she's just finished implementing. We'll be deploying in the next few weeks, and we'll maybe begin to see some impact from that. But I think you're absolutely right. Enabling feedback loops at all levels is where the fun stuff is, where you start having learning processes and intelligent systems.
I'm Nicolas de Corgan, CDC Atlanta. My question is for the three of you. I would be interested in knowing which diseases are covered by your system, and if this is relevant, what challenge were related to integrate more diseases than what it was initially designed for?
Okay. For OpenMRS, it's able to handle all kind of diseases, especially with the primary care integration. We're able to collect reproductive health information. You're able to collect any kind of data on all diseases into the system. Yeah.
Like I mentioned, the system was designed first for HIV program, but since last year we have primary care, maternal health also. The challenge, it was a tough process. When we have to put the primary care, so we have so many departments involved, and you have to have agreement of all these people, what we should put on the forms, things like this. So it was very hard to have the final decision. Maybe it take we 1 year to design only the forms before to pass to implementation.
Smart Care began not as a system, but as a card. But when it became a system, it was first an MCH application. The second module that was added was either VCT or ART, both around the same time. And those things were sort of driven by both the opportunity to replace an existing system by rolling in their functionality and, of course, by PEPFAR funding. It moved from there into categorical capture of pharmacy and laboratory elements, and I may not get all the sequences right here, labor and delivery postnatal, and under five and family planning are just going out. And the last and most difficult was general primary care, getting back to your question, Roger, because that was the only service for which there wasn't an existing form and an existing standard of practice in the country. And it basically was the catch-all for every possible thing that could happen. And so making that simple and yet making it comprehensive, it has to be a four-minute clinical interaction and a 30-second data capture step, was really the most difficult thing. I think we're getting pretty close to releasing that, perhaps in a few more weeks.
Thank you, Dr. Marks. We have time for like two brief questions. So, okay, one.
Thanks for a great presentation. My name is Nelson. I'm an epidemiologist at CDC. Actually, I have two questions. It appears that Mark already alluded to the first one, which relates more to the downtown. He indicated that since we are all using smart cards now, so apparently there will not be a downtown for the maintenance of the system also. But the question that I actually wanted to ask is to the gentleman from Kenya. It appears that the way your system is set up, or the way you are setting it up now, household is actually your index, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. You can do analysis using your index, using household as a metric. But the problem is you're not going to be able to look at individuals, which in public health is very, 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 very important. There are instances when household data are very important. And there are instances when you actually wanted to look at patient data to be able to let us know what is going on at that level, as opposed to looking at the household level. I don't know whether in future you intended to break down this household into individual patient level, so you can be able to see what is going on at that level. But if you leave the analysis just at the household level, it's going to be able to confound what you're going to be able to make of the data.
Okay, maybe just to clarify, I concentrated on the household part of the system. The reason is because that's the extension that we've had in the clinical information system, to be able to take care of public health needs. But MRS began as a patient-focused medical record system. And at this moment, it's actually like it has two perspectives. You can look at the information from an individual perspective, or from a household perspective. So at the end of the day, we are still able to collect individual information, that is by clinicians, into the system, or when you go to the community, or you get the programs that deals with household level information, you're able to add data into the same EMR from both angles. So you can still, we're still able to analyze the patient level information, but we've extended it to be able to analyze household level information. So you're able to do both sides. It's still being used for clinical, and now it can be used for household level information. And just to add on that is, for example, for public health needs, assuming a clinician sees a patient and identifies a disease that could affect the community around there, assuming you want to go and see the people who may be affected, for example, by TB, you're able to see who are close to that person. And that's an intervention that can be given from a clinical perspective to a public health perspective. So you can look at our EMR from both angles, individual and household.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone has one? Any last question? If not, then let us thank James, Emmanuel, and Mark. Yeah, thanks.